Interview with Joseph Hardiman, October 29th, 2009, in Baltimore, Maryland, by Kenneth Durr. All right, well, thanks for taking some time to talk to me.
Sure.
And I'm getting the sense that maybe you're a Baltimore native, or...
I'm a Maryland native.
Okay.
And have spent most of my, all of my professional career and adult life in Baltimore. But I was born and raised on the eastern shore of Maryland.
Okay. Where'd you go to school?
I went to the University of Maryland, College Park, undergraduate school. Graduated in 59, then I went directly to the law school and graduated from the law school in 1962. And then I spent a year clerking on the Court of Appeals of Maryland with a judge by the name of Hall Hammond, who became the chief judge of the Court of Appeals, but he was not at that time. Mm-hmm. And his impact on my future was significant, both in terms of my career as a lawyer and my subsequent career in the investment business.
In what way? Did you start to get into securities law fairly early, or how did that happen?
No, yes and no. With him, I was doing a lot of legal writing, and I really learned how to write, but also... he was the trustee of a number of significant trusts, and while I clerked for him, I worked with him on the investments of those trusts, so
okay.
Started to tickle my interest in investments there.
Okay.
But he was the one that really said, you know, as you develop, don't just restrict your thinking to the private practice of law. Think about where your career may take you and what other opportunities there may be.
So it took you into Alex Brown?
No, I spent, I didn't heed his advice at first. I wanted to try the law, and I did. And I went to work with a firm of Miles and Stockbridge, which is a large Baltimore-based firm.
Right.
For 5 years, I did corporate and securities work, primarily representing what is known in the trade as issuers, or those of the companies that are issuing securities. And I would work long hours doing preparing the prospectus and other documents, and then I'd go to the closings, and I would see that the investment bankers were making all the money and I was doing all the work. But I practiced law for 5 years, and it really was... a rewarding practice, but developed an itch to move more into the world of securities and investment banking. In 1968, when the securities industry was really facing some challenging times in terms of its ability to process the paper that they were generating, because it was a paper it was a paper business. Every time there was a securities transaction, there had to be a piece of paper that passed back and forth between the buyer and the seller, whether it's a certificate or documents. And the industry was having some serious digestion problems. In fact, during that period of time, the New York Stock Exchange used to close one day a week in order to be able to handle the paperwork of doing 2 million shares a day.
So you came in the middle of the back office crunch.
I came in the middle of the back office crunch in 1968, September of 1968. The industry was also becoming, in the late 60s, more compliance conscious. I was hired as an assistant to the president of a small firm by the name of Robert Garrett & Sons, which was the second oldest investment bank in America, founded in 1819. From that perspective, I was able to, and it was a small firm, 120 person firm, that engaged in a general securities business, investment banking, asset management, securities trading, obviously, brokerage, and municipal bond activities. And from that perspective, I was able to to see, to learn a little bit about all aspects of the business. Small firm, general securities firm, doing many different things. And as assistant to the president, I was able to do many different things. And I spent a good deal of my time, at least half, helping organize the back office and getting that to a point where it could handle the paper flow that was choking the industry. Mm-hmm. But in doing so, I got an exposure to the industry as well. And, you know, that was a very helpful thing later in my career. So that's how I got started, and I was with Robert Garrett and Sons, and I worked in all aspects of the business until we sold the business in 1974 to Alex Brown. And I stayed on. We sold the business and settled it in September. And I stayed on and closed the firm down until the end of the year. And then I joined Alex Brown in January 1st of 1975.
Okay. What position did you come into then?
I for a one-year period of time, I came in as the administrative partner. And I was in charge of all of the administrative side of the business.
That back office experience.
That was back office. That was legal and compliance. That was human resources. That was, you name it, administrative services. Overseeing the, well, not at the outset overseeing, but working with the branch offices. But I was not doing any investment banking work per se. And I was not doing any securities trading work, but everything else.
Now, you had mentioned that this firm had a, was in at the ground floor, the founding of the NASD. Did people talk about that? Was there more involvement than there may have been in other firms because
yes.
of that?
Yes. As a result of that, there, Alex Brown had long standing involvement with the NASD, and a number of the partners of Alex Brown had been members of the Board of Governors of the NASD, starting with Benjamin H. Griswold II, who I believe was the first chairman of the NASD. And an historical fact that probably we should check. But you know, there had been several partners. There were still there were still several partners at the time who were active with the NASD, and I was encouraged, not at the very outset because I was just getting to know the firm and the people, but I was encouraged to become involved with the NASD and with the industry matters, and I did. So that legacy was there, if you will. And then that I got involved in the district level, and, you know, sitting in on district business conduct cases as a volunteer from the industry, which Alex Brown always supplied people to do. And then eventually in 1984, I was elected to the Board of Governors of the NASD.
Okay. You were talking about doing this volunteer work on the district level. Are these enforcement type cases?
Yes.
Discipline?
These are... This is, we'll step back a second.
And, sure.
You know, the NASD was established in, well, the Maloney Act was
38.
And I think the NASD came into existence in 39. Okay. And there was only one, as you probably have learned, only one CEO for about 25 years. It was, you know, established to... make sure that the members of the NASD abided by just and equitable principles of trade and fair dealing with its customers and among its members. And one of the processes they had from the very get-go for assuring that was a industry self-involvement in hearing cases against both firms and individuals who were charged with violating either the rules of the NASD or the rules, regulations, and laws of the Securities Act that were the purview of the SEC as well. So what happened was around the country, and I wasn't going to go hear a case in Seattle, Washington, or Dallas, Texas. So around the country, they developed a series of districts, and each district had a an NEASD staff who would investigate and bring the cases, and then you had a series of volunteers from that particular district who would hear the case and determine what disciplinary action, if any, was appropriate. And then there was an appellate process if the person or the firm decided they wanted to appeal the decision of the District Business Conduct Committee, which was their peers. It was a trial by peers. They could appeal to the National Business Conduct Committee, which was a committee of the NESD Board of Governors, the National Board of Governors.
Okay. So they'd go to Washington or something?
Yes. And so that, you know, that was kind of the early history of the NESD, and what it primarily engaged in its early history was investigating complaints, also examining firms, looking for examples of misconduct, or also making sure firms were financially viable and stable and not violating the net capital rules.
And there so, were there broker exams as well?
No, I don't think so. That's a good question, Ken. I'm not sure of that. I think that came along quite a bit later.
Okay.
There was broker registration required, but I don't think there were broker exams.
Okay.
And I don't know when that exam process began. So that was the activity.
So you were involved first as
so
a volunteer.
I volunteered at the district level, just hearing, you know, cases that were initiated by the NEASD staff against a member or a registered representative and sitting in judgment on those. And then I became a member of the district committee itself. Each committee, each district had its own oversight committee. And then from that, each district then had a representative on the national board, and I was chosen to represent the Mid-Atlantic District in 1984.
Okay.
So and that's how I got to the NESD Board of Governors in 1984.
Okay.
But I was still, you know, full-time in the industry, and this was
right.
A volunteer activity.
Now, this is the period when Gordon Macklin is in charge.
Absolutely.
And the NASDAQ is going up.
Gordon was there from 1970 to 1987. As an aside, I always called him the locust because it was a 17-year period of time.
Tell me a little bit about him. Did you know him very well?
I know him very well. He was a very gregarious and smart investment professional who believed strongly in the concept of self-regulation. He, as you probably know, he came out of the securities firm of McDonald in Cleveland. He had been involved also as a volunteer with the NESD from that Ohio district. And he was hired, I guess he would have been the third president and CEO of the NESD. I think it was the third. There may have been a little brief period of time when there was a gap when they were searching for a new CEO, that there was an industry acting CEO.
Yeah, I can look into that.
I think that was a guy named Stretch Gardner from Robert Gardner, who was then with Reynolds and Company. But that would have been about 1970. But Stretch would have only been there for a couple of months.
And, okay.
But Gordon was the third president and CEO.
He said he believed very strongly in the concept of self-regulation.
Yes.
What did that mean in concrete terms to him? Did he must have shared this vision with you a little bit.
Well, you know, he really felt that the NASD was charged by the Maloney Act with assuring that its members not only complied with the securities laws, but also with dealing with investors, both large and small, institutional and individual, on a fair basis. He also, I think, felt that the industry, it was very much in the industry's best interest to police itself, and that while regulation sometimes can seem onerous, that effective regulation, well carried out, would enhance the industry and its relationship with investors. And that drove him much more than anything else, is that feeling that, listen, if we police ourselves well and do a good job and make sure our members treat our investors fairly, then that's going to enhance the reputation. It's going to build the business, going to help the business grow. So one of his great expressions was, good compliance is good business. Good compliance is good business.
Now, did he do anything to change the self-regulatory structure during the time he was in there, during his 17 years?
No, I don't know that I could say that he did anything to change the regulatory structure. Let's check the fact. I believe the testing requirements came into place before Gordon was there.
Okay.
The testing, I believe, but I'm not sure of this, that the arbitration in practices were established before he was there. So in terms of enforcement, in terms of arbitrating disputes, in terms of registering and testing individuals that are going to be engaged in the business, I think all those were in place before Gordon was there. I'm not 100% sure of that, but I think they clearly were in place when I got there. So I don't know that he did anything to change the basic concept of the NASD. I think he thought it was well constructed from the get-go.
Okay.
That it had been well managed for a period of, you know, say 1940 to 1970, 31 years before he got there.
And obviously, the challenges grew when the automated quote system.
Well, that's right. Now, this is where Gordon, I think, made his real contribution. And he was, as I think I want to describe him really, he was a great investor. He was investing was his first love. And when, as a result of an SEC study in the 1960s about how you could improve the quality of information in the over-the-counter markets, the fragmented over-the-counter markets in the United States, was published. The SEC did a thorough study and recommended that the NASD or some other organization establish a nationwide system of quotations for the over-the-counter market. Gordon and the NASD board rose to the challenge very quickly.
Do you remember those discussions?
I was not a participant in those discussions at the time, so I would not have had firsthand knowledge of them. But Stretch Gardner, the name that I mentioned earlier, happens to be my next door neighbor in Florida. And that's by accident, things turned out. But he was a very active participant in there. And going back to the over-the-counter markets, they were, you know, we had a system of a few large national firms in New York then. But a lot of the business and the securities business, particularly with individual investors, and the institutional investors at that stage in the game were not a major factor. They were much more individual. It was done locally, by local firms or regional firms. So, you know, if an investor wanted to buy shares in a company that was located in Seattle, they would go to a Seattle firm, a stock brokerage firm, and that Seattle firm would make a market in most of the local stocks.
Right.
And so you would buy it, and that's where the name over-the-counter comes from. You would go into their brokerage firm, you would put up your cash over-the-counter, and they would in turn take that cash and give you the certificate. And it was all manual, and you either had to go into their offices or call on the telephone to get a quote.
So all these market makers are localized.
Are all localized. They're all over the country. I mean, and there were literally hundreds of them, maybe even thousands at that stage in the game. And they were all local. And unless the stock was quoted on the New York Stock Exchange at that stage in the game, they had a fairly small base of maybe 1,000 or so of the very large national companies. But everything else was traded locally. So it was a fragmented market. And if I were sitting in Baltimore and I wanted to buy a Seattle company, stock in a Seattle company, let's say Microsoft didn't exist at the time, but a Microsoft, Nordstrom's might have existed at the time, I'd have to go to my broker here in Baltimore. He, in turn, would have to call a broker in Seattle. He would get a quote over the telephone, and that quote would then be relayed to me, and I would then make a decision as to whether I wanted to buy or if I were to sell or whether I wanted to sell at those quoted prices. But because it took such a long period of time, the quotes could change between the time that... Mm-hmm. So it was a very inefficient market and fragmented market. And the SEC study in the 60s pointed that out rightly and said we need to centralize this market and we need to bring some degree of automation to it.
That's a good description of, say, pre-1970 over-the-counter.
Yes.
How much had that changed in that 10 or so years before you got to the board? How did it look when you were on the board?
Well, before I got to the board... Okay, what changed? It was beginning in 1971. So what happens, the NESD and at the urging of its board and Gordon, hired Bunker Ramo to develop this system. And Bunker Ramo developed the system, and they own the system. But the NESD very wisely negotiated an option to buy it. And so they developed the system. But that system, the initial system, was just a system of quotes. And so instead of me having to call the broker in Seattle, a terminal in Baltimore, not I as an investor, but I as a brokerage firm, Robert Garrett & Sons at the time, I could bring up Nordstrom's on a screen, and I could see all the brokers in the Western United States that may have been quoting Nordstrom's, and then I'd still had to call that broker. I couldn't execute through that screen. I had to pick it up and call the broker and buy or sell the securities. And that's, with one wrinkle, that's pretty much the way the market was. So that, and then two wrinkles. Yeah, starting from 1971, and then in the mid-70s, they added the next feature, and that is after there was an execution, then the broker executing the trade on behalf of the customer had to report it to the NASD through NASDAQ, and they introduced trade reporting. So now you could see the quotations of the various dealers that were making markets, but you could see last sale information, and you could see whether those, where the executions were taking place versus
right.
Where the quotations were. But that became not only a market enhancer, but also a good compliance tool because it enabled the NASD to take a look at the executions and determine whether the customer was getting a quote-unquote best execution. So it was helpful both from a market efficiency point of view, but also a regulatory oversight point of view. And that continued to be pretty much, that was pretty much the market when I came into, when I started getting involved with the NASD as a volunteer.
Was a small order execution system in?
Not yet, no. That came in, I think it was 1984.
Yeah, about the time you went onto the board, I guess.
Yeah, about the time I went on the board. And that was the next wrinkle. That was the next. So we had a quotation system, a trade reporting system, but no execution system. Everything had to be done over the telephone.
Right.
So in 1984, they developed a small order execution system. And for the first time, I think in any market anywhere in the world, there was the ability to automatically execute a transaction without any active dialogue between two human beings. But it was only for 100 shares. And participation was voluntary. You did not have to. If I were Robert Garrett and Sons, I could participate only in the quotation side and trade reporting side, but I did not have to participate in the small order execution side.
Why would someone opt to participate or not to participate?
They would... The larger firms with stronger, larger order flow, the large national firms like Merrill Lynch at the time, would participate because they had such large order flow that if they could automatically execute small orders without having to manually handle them, it reduced their cost and improved their efficiency. The smaller firms, however, were reluctant to participate because they did not want the exposure of having somebody to be able to execute automatically against their quotes without their seeing that and knowing what their exposure may be, even though it's for 100 shares. The larger firms, 100 shares, you know, if the quote was, let's say, at the time, and the spreads were fairly wide, let's say it was 25 to a quarter, you know, they didn't care.
Mm-hmm.
But for a smaller firm with much less capital and much less risk tolerance, yeah, they did care because it could have an impact upon them and their capital adequacy. So that's basically
okay.
The reasons why some firms chose to participate. And it became a matter of volume. I mean, firms of the larger volume just did it because it was more efficient and they had the capital adequacy. They could, if they lost some money on these small transactions,
okay.
So be it. The smaller firm saying, I can't afford to lose money on these smaller transactions, you know.
So they're still using pink sheets at this point?
They're not using pink sheets. They're using NASDAQ for NASDAQ stocks, the NASDAQ quotation system. Because they could see the quotations, but they would still call up
okay.
to have an execution.
Okay.
Now, the pink sheets were there.
Who was using those?
They were, with the advent of NASDAQ, not many people realize this, but gosh, when I went into the NASD and NASDAQ in 1987, there were almost 50,000 publicly quoted securities. Now, only about 7,500 or 8,000 of those were quoted either on one of the exchanges or in NASDAQ. There's this huge number of small, mostly penny stocks, mining stocks, things that were still quoted through the pink sheets. So, you know, If you weren't listed on NASDAQ, or if you weren't listed on one of the exchanges, you had to go to the pink sheets.
Okay.
And that continued to be, and I, you know, the pink sheets still exist as far as I know. And that continues to be the case today, although not, you don't have anywhere near the number of stocks quoted in there. And two, you've gotten a good deal more stocks quoted on the securities exchanges and NASDAQ today.
Tell me the circumstances that you're coming in to take over from Gordon Macklin.
Mm. Okay. So that was kind of the situation. The NESD was in good shape. I mean, it was functioning mm-hmm. well, carrying out its responsibilities well. And the NASDAQ market was just beginning to really in early stages of growth. I mean, from 71 until it introduced the small order execution system in 84, it was still kind of just a quotation system. But when that happened, you know, it started to become a real market, if you will. And that's the way things were when I arrived. I had served 3 years on the board. I was in my third year. I had been elected as chairman of the board by my peers. So I was the industry chair of the board. Gordon was the president and CEO. I got to know him very well during that 1 year where we overlapped, because the chairman spent a good deal of time with the president. And then he announced in May of 1987 that after 17 years, I think, of strong leadership of the organization, he was going to go back to the industry. And he was going to leave to become... Well, he announced in February when I said May. He announced in February and he was going to leave in June to become chairman of Hambrick & Quist, a San Francisco-based firm, a very good San Francisco-based investment banking firm. And so chairman of the board, is my duty to form a search committee, and I did. It was chaired by David Hunter of Parker & Hunter. An interesting character, by the way. If you ever want to talk to somebody about the history of the NESD and the exchanges, he served them all. He's still up in Pittsburgh. They came to me after, in the May of that year, they came to me and said, you know, would you have any interest in succeeding Gordon? And both of my children were then, both of my children were in college. And so they were out of the roost. And going back to my legal background and training again, on the legal and regulatory side, the NESD side, and my experience in the industry with Robert Garrett and Alex Brown, they kind of felt, and then my involvement in the NESD, they kind of felt I would be a natural choice. Now, I think Gordon had something to do with that, but I don't know that.
It's likely.
But I think it's likely that he had something to do with that. So they approached me, and I decided, you know, it would be a great way to spend some time in a quasi-public service role, mm-hmm. Giving back to the industry and satisfying a personal desire that I had always had from a youngster to serve in some capacity, in some public service capacity. And here I could do it within an industry that I knew and enjoyed. And so I think that's one, caught me at a good time. Two, Alex Brown had gone public the year before. I preferred the partnership mode. I thought the partnership mode was a better mode for operating a securities firm than a corporate, publicly owned mode. And so it wasn't a decision that I was particularly enthralled with. So everything just came together.
So you were ready to make a change.
I was ready to make a change, Ken. That's right.
Well, you got a big change because you landed in there right before the market break.
You're right. So I agreed in late May, early June of 87 that I would take on that role. And I committed to them that I would serve at least 5, but not more than 10 years. And you know, I did that because I felt that you had to be there, be within an organization for at least 5 years to have an impact, a meaningful impact. And if you stay more than 10, you probably stay too long. It's good for the organization to have change, and it's good for you, the individual, to have change. Mm-hmm. So with that understanding, I took it on, and took on the role September 1st, 1987. And I never will forget Gordon and I in our last chat, and I said, well, now, tell me, what are the problems? Are there any challenges? What are the issues? And he says, everything's in great shape. He said, the NESD is in terrific shape. The NASDAQ stock market's in terrific shape. And at the time, NASDAQ had enjoyed quite a nice little run, and things were going along seemingly well. So I thought I'd have at least a little time to get to know the organization and its professionals and the skills of its people. And I embarked on that. One of the first things I did after spending the month of September in Washington getting to know the staff and there and in Rockville, where the NESD had an operations center, and up in Trumbull, where we had the NASDAQ operations. In early October, I said, okay, I'm going to visit every district office. So I embarked on a program of visiting every district office. And lo and behold, on October the 16th of 1987, I was in the Denver office. And I got a call from an individual who subsequently became a very great friend and an employee of the NESD, and that's Rick Ketchum. And Rick was then the head of Division of Market Regulation at the SEC. And I had been over to call on him when I first, like I called on all the commissioners. And, mm-hmm. But I didn't really know Rick, and he basically said, have you been following the markets closely today? And I said, well, I've been traveling. I know that we are having a sharply down day, but I haven't paid a lot of attention to it. And he said, we think that there are some fundamental problems that may result in a significant sell-off here. We think you ought to make sure your systems are in good shape and your people are alerted. I said, great, thanks for the heads up. And scooted back to Washington as quickly as I could and spent the whole weekend doing exactly as he suggested. And then, of course, on Monday, we had the fateful market. To look back, we called it a crash at the time. And at the time, everybody thought it was a crash. Now, in light of what's happened since then, it's probably just a sharp market decline. But
right.
It was a very difficult day, and I really got my baptism under fire that day.
How did the NASDAQ respond as opposed to one of the exchanges where there was just so much volume?
We had huge volume too, probably more than our systems could handle, but. Our problem, Monday was, let's start putting things in kind of, Monday was a more challenging day for the exchanges than it was for us. Because quite naturally, investors, when they thought that there was a crash coming, went to what they thought was the most liquid market they could find, New York Stock Exchange. And so they were banging the New York Stock Exchange pretty hard that day, and their specialists were getting hit hugely hard. And the specialists were undercapitalized at the time and really were having a difficult time acting as the buyer of last resort. And our problem that day was going back to the structure of the NASDAQ market. That small order execution system was voluntary, and the market makers as a whole withdrew, even the large ones. So that the only way you could get through to them was on the telephone. The telephones became clogged. People couldn't get through on the telephone to the market makers in these securities. So, you know, I was getting complaints from particularly larger institutional investors that they were not able to get through. And, I mean, we were getting feedback that the smaller investors were having too, but they weren't contacting me directly, that their investors were having a very difficult time getting through to the market makers and executing transactions. And they thought it because the market makers were just not answering the telephone. So we immediately dispatched. We had our people alerted over the weekend. Our staff members around the country and the districts out to the market makers to monitor.
They'd physically go?
Yeah, they would go physically into their trading rooms and monitor.
Okay.
And where there's some, yes, that were not answering their telephones as a way to avoid having to have to buy securities at rapidly declining prices. But for the most part, the communication systems were inadequate. They were swamped. People couldn't get through because the lines were busy. Thousands of people trying to get through a very small telephonic-based system.
Okay. I understood there was also a deal where they were putting the bid price above the ask price or something like
well,
that.
Well, they weren't doing that. What happens is that happened a lot. If, let's say I'm a market maker and you're a market maker in Microsoft, and I was offering to buy it at 20 and sell it at 20 and a half. Well, that day, just in all markets, in exchange markets and NASDAQ markets and over-the-counter markets. By the way, NASDAQ was only a small portion of the over-the-counter market then.
Mm-hmm.
We probably had 1,500 securities listed, you know, out of thousands. But if I were quoting 20, I would say I'd buy at 20 and sell at 20 and a half. And you were coming in and saying you would sell at 20, that constituted what they call a cross market. And what our system did was to show the best buy, the best bid, and best ask. So it could get crossed. And so maybe your quote crossed mine, and the price at which you were selling was better than the price at which I was buying, which normally means I should have been buying your securities.
Right.
But that wasn't happening. So the screen was showing these cross markets. Instead of market being 20 to a half, it was showing the market as being 20 on one side, 19 and three quarters on the other. Not a positive bid and ask, it was a negative.
Okay.
Didn't work.
And it was because of this communications.
It was because different market makers were changing their quotes so quickly the systems couldn't keep up with the changes. So we discovered a couple of things. One, the communications networks were inadequate.
Okay.
Two, the systems needed to be modified to eliminate just this phenomenon we were talking about, what we call locked-in cross markets. There were lots of locked-in cross markets. And three, the SO system, which was designed to handle increased volume, wasn't there when it was on a voluntary basis. The market makers all withdrew. So what should have been a source of reducing the communications gap and the execution gap became, and when they all pulled out, it became an exacerbator of the problem. So in the aftermath, and it was our big day was Tuesday, and I'll just give you this as an example of history. The exchange markets had struggled hard on Monday. we were getting hit hard on Tuesday. And I was getting calls from market makers on Monday afternoon, but primarily on Tuesday morning, and from big firms and small firms saying, you've got to close the markets. You know, we're getting killed. We don't have the capital to buy back in all the securities that are being offered to us. And the same thing was happening with the exchange specialists. And about 11:45 or so, I got a call from John Phelan, who was in the president. I guess I don't know if he was the chairman. He was certainly the CEO,
yeah.
Whether he was president, chairman, or but certainly the CEO of the New York Stock Exchange, saying, "Listen, you know, our specialists are running out of capital. We can't continue to operate. We're going to close the markets in at 12:30 if this thing continues to go down." And he and I had a conversation, and we both agreed it would be a disastrous thing for the markets to close, because markets are there not only to provide price discovery, but also there to provide liquidity. And when markets are closed, particularly during normal market hours, they can provide neither. And that's when panic ensues. Mm-hmm. And we didn't talk long about it, which is, you know, it'd be a terrible thing to do, but if you close your market, we've got no choice but to close ours. Well, fortunately, Alan Greenspan came to everybody's rescue. And as much as he's being maligned today for more recent events, he took absolutely the right action at that stage in the game. He gave banks increased access to the Fed window, and he gave brokers and dealers access to the Fed window as well, so that they could be sure that they could get the capital, and two, that the counterparties on the other side would be there to settle the transactions. And with that, once he announced that, the market took a sharp turn the other direction. And interestingly, by the end of the week, it was up. It was back to even for the week. And by the end of the year, 1987, it was above its high. Hmm. So it was a short-term phenomenon, but we learned a lot.
Yeah, it sounds like it. Now, did you sit down and set out to remedy those three things you talked about?
Absolutely. We convened a two things were happening. One, the government, the U.S. government, through the offices of the Secretary of Treasury, Nick Brady, I think, was the secretary at the time, convened a group to study the causes and the impact and to recommend remedies for the market crash. But at the same time, we at the NESD convened a group primarily of market makers, of NASDAQ market makers, to discuss the problems that we discovered. And ironically, that group was led by two people. One was Bernie Madoff, who was the leading wholesale market maker in both NASDAQ and exchange-listed securities, and very much regarded by his peers as being the leader. And then a fellow named Victor Wright, who was in charge of NASDAQ trading at Goldman Sachs. So we had a large firm, then we had a wholesale firm. And then we had representatives of regional firms. But those were the two leaders. And we got them all together a number of times in New York and Washington. We said, okay, how are we going to solve these problems? I took a look at it. From my view, it was an opportunity. It was an opportunity to improve the quality of the NASDAQ stock market. Yes, it demonstrated some flaws, serious flaws, but you know, you could lament those flaws or you could do something about it. So basically, we said we're going to do something about it. And so they came up, the committee, and here's again where the self is involved. Clearly with our encouragement, but they came up with the idea of, one, making SOES, the small order execution system, participation mandatory, and increasing the size to either 500 shares or 1,000 shares, depending upon the size and liquidity of the stock. And then that was a major change.
Yeah, making this thing mandatory.
Making it mandatory and increasing the size of the transactions that can be executed. Because then a lot of these problems that were demonstrated by either the inability or the unwillingness to answer telephones during the market crash could be resolved.
Right.
And so we quickly moved in that direction. Secondly, we made some significant upgrades and changes to the NASDAQ market systems, increasing the capacity and also eliminating the ability to have locked and cross markets. And then I think those were...
Did you ever consider circuit breakers? Everybody else was...
No, we did not consider circuit breakers. I did not believe in circuit breakers. And I guess, you know, again, a circuit breaker as originally proposed would have been that if you hit certain benchmarks, the markets would close for a period of time. If markets are closed, they can't provide price discovery or liquidity.
Right.
And I thought that's the most important role of the markets. And even though it may be painful, that it's very important from a public point of view to keep markets open rather than closing them. So I fought the concept of circuit breakers.
Because this was probably something the Brady Commission was talking about, too.
Well, they were, yes, absolutely. One of my ultimate successors as head of the NASD, Bob Glauber, Bob was on the task force that Nick Brady put together. But the exchange was enamored with circuit breakers and ultimately came to a reasonable conclusion. And that is, you know, there should be, and this was kind of, we batted this back and forth, negotiated it, even though the NASD and NASDAQ never accepted circuit breakers, and during my tenure never had them. But the exchange went to a step circuit breaker at certain levels, then options trading would halt. At another level, another step would take, but you wouldn't stop trading until the market was down 10%, basically. And then, you know, they would stop trading. Well, I kept saying to him, you know, if you want to do it, you got to do it on a percentage basis, because if the market's at 2,500, then it only has to be down 250. Mm-hmm. If it's at 1,000, being down 250, and by the way, the initial proposal was, I think, down 250. And I was saying, you know, what if the market's at 5,000? Down 250 doesn't really mean that much. 10,000, down 250. In today's world, that's right. An ordinary day. I mean, it's not extraordinary. So they finally agreed, I think, to a percentage. But we didn't, the NASD and NASDAQ did not consider installing circuit breakers for our market.
So... how did you go about making SOs mandatory? Did you simply take it to the membership?
First of all, Bernie and Victor took it to the NASDAQ trading community as a whole. They met with a number of the leading NASDAQ market makers, both regional and New York-based. And, yes, there was some resistance. But to give Bernie his credit, he was a leader. And he said, look, you know, each time we have put into a new rule or policy or systems change to the NASDAQ market, it has increased the quality of that market and thereby has increased the volume of activity. So, yes, you may not make as much money per trade, on a transaction, but with the increased volume, you're going to offset right. that.
Did it work out that way?
Yes, it did. Okay. Every time we made an enhancement to the NASDAQ stock market, that was a result. The volume picked up, credibility increased, and the quality of the markets improved, and the confidence of the investors in the markets improved.
Okay.
And by the way, we had institutional investors participate in that as well as market makers. They were providing us with input. So, you know, we took those actions, and that was, I think we probably had them largely done, certainly by the end of 88.
Was there a sense at this point that you wanted to bring people back in too? Because a lot of folks did bail out of the market, at least for a short period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I know you started some pretty big public relations type of...
We didn't start those until after we had made these changes. Those really didn't start. That became a concept in 1989. But yes, we knew that we had... within NASDAQ, both a recognition issue of the market and also a credibility issue. That once we had made the fixes that we were all comfortable with, then we had to go out and start selling the market and branding the market, if you will.
Who was behind that?
It was interesting how that worked. But let me just throw one little...
Sure.
It wasn't little from a time point of view. The other thing we had to do was to go out and convince the state securities regulators. I mean, of course, we had federal regulation and you had self-regulation, and then every state had its own regulatory either laws or regulations. And they were, and I assume continue to be a fairly strong voice in regulations. And NASDAQ had never been exempted from the blue sky laws, companies listed on NASDAQ. But the exchanges, the New York and American Stock Exchange, had security exemptions. And so the companies that were listing on NASDAQ, each time they had a financing, they had to go get reviewed by 50 state securities regulators as well as the SEC and ourselves. And so the companies said to me that basically, in addition to improving the quality of the systems and the credibility of the market, you've got to get rid of this issue. So I spent the good part of 1989 and the early part of 1990 going out and meeting with state securities regulators, legislators, governors in some instances, trying to get these laws, NASDAQ exempted from these laws. And I was successful.
Were you able to really deal with NASA mostly? I
mean, what happened was a very good question, and thanks for the. I was dealing with the states one on one, but I was also negotiating with the leaders of NASA, and we were trying to get to the point where, they could recommend this to their members and.
Okay.
We finally got to a memorandum of understanding with NASA. Sometime in 1989.
So they understood the concept of why you needed to do this.
Yeah, they understood it. You know, they weren't, basically, they were more interested in the potential loss of revenues. Because each time a company was having a securities offering, it had to file, and it had to pay a filing fee. And that was a significant source of revenues to help underwrite their securities law and regulation enforcement activities. So the memorandum of understanding basically said, okay, we will exempt NASDAQ companies from the blue sky laws, but each time there's a filing with you, and they all had to be filed with us, even if it was a New York Stock Exchange or American Stock Exchange or Chicago or what listing. Anytime there's a new offering of securities, they had to be reviewed by us and by the SEC. SEC would collect its fees. We would collect fees for all everybody else, and we would pay them those fees that they would otherwise have been entitled to. Mm. So they didn't lose that source of revenue. And I could understand their issue.
The fees weren't the problem for you.
No, the fees were not the problem for us, nor were they for our issuers. They were not the problem at all.
Okay.
So now this gets to, so now we've got a market that's accepted by the state securities regulators, exempted from their blue sky laws. We've got the systems improved. But we still have to. So in 1990, I hired a marketing for the first time. There may have been marketing executives in other exchanges, but for the NASD and NASDAQ, it was the first time. And he was employed by NASDAQ. And his name was Brian Holland, and he came out of...
Holland?
Holland, H-O-L-L-A-N-D.
Okay.
Brian Holland. And Brian was at a marketing and advertising, primarily advertising background. He's a very bright guy. And it was his idea. He said, before we start any marketing program, let's go out and find out what investors think about us. So for a good part of a year, he conducted surveys. He conducted one-on-ones. He conducted group sessions and got a lot of information about what investors, institutional investors, individual investors, thought of the NASDAQ stock market and the oversight of that market by the NASD. So he built quite a case, and then he came back and he said, first of all, he said, acceptance comes with recognition. And according to our polls, if you ask an investor to unaided name a stock market in the United States, 87% would name the New York Stock Exchange. 39% would name the American Stock Exchange. And only 20% would name NASDAQ. Our problem isn't just one of credibility, it's one of recognition. They don't recognize us as a stock market, mm-hmm. per se. Okay, what do we do about it? Well, we started a marketing campaign that was aimed at branding NASDAQ as a stock market, and as a stock market that you could trust. And this began the first effort ever to advertise and brand. With Brian's leadership, and certainly with our high support and with monies, our members were every securities firm in the United States, large and small. Sell any securities in the United States, you had to be a member of the NASD. This is going to go where you want, I think, want me to go eventually. Until that time, until the market crash of 1987 and the events that followed, the NASD had been the primary organization, and NASDAQ was the tail on the dog. Small in comparison to the whole organization in terms of revenues, in terms of time devoted, in terms of employees. We were operating this automated quotation system and trade reporting system that generated some revenues for us out here, but it wasn't. But then along came 1987 and recognition that we had a real problem. And the events that followed and the improvement in the marketplace, we said, now we've done this. Let's start to build this marketplace and build this as a brand and to build it Our strategic goal was to build it as a viable, competitive alternative to the New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
Not just a place where young new companies would raise their initial capital through a public offering, grow up, and then migrate to the New York Stock Exchange. We want to keep the Microsofts. We want to keep the Intels.
Now, was this the ad campaign where you brought those companies out?
That's right. This was the ad. And what happened was that I went to our members and said, most of them NASD members, and the NASD board was composed primarily of representatives from every district and a couple of market makers. And out of the 22 governors or so at the time, I'd say 17 were from the industry and 5 were from the public. And only one of those was from a NASDAQ issuer. And that was Bill McGowan of MCI. And, you know, so we went to our board and our members and they said, well, you know, we belong to the New York Stock Exchange and why should we be funding, why should the members be funding this campaign? Because you're going to be running advertisements that are going to be promoting the NASDAQ stock market and, you know, we don't want you to do it with our money. Well, that was a setback. So then we took a look at the fees that we charge for listing on NASDAQ versus what the New York Stock Exchange charged. And ours were 1/100th of their fees. Our fees were negligible. So that led us to go out, and I went out and called on all of our leading companies. And I said, would you, and you know, you guys are in the marketing business, particularly the technology companies. And by the way, the technology companies made our stock market because they felt comfortable with a screen-based market.
Right.
And they knew that that was the future rather than a floor-based market. So we would go to the Microsofts and the Intels and the Ciscos and MCIs of the world, say, all right, we want to start this marketing campaign, which will begin with branding. We will feature one of you in each of our ads if you will go along with an increase in your listing fees. We'll still be well below the New York Stock Exchange. So we increased them, basically from $10,000 to $50,000 for the larger companies, and for those companies it probably would have been $250,000 for them to list them, with their acquiescence. And then they agreed to participate in these ads. And that it was the companies that funded that whole program. It wasn't the members. So it removed the conflict that the members had. And it turned out to be hugely successful. I mean, I can remember when we ran our first ad, I got a furious call from Dick Grasso at the New York Stock Exchange saying, what are you doing? You know, you're running ads and that promote your market at the expense of the New York Stock Exchange. So I said, Dick, the only thing we're doing is trying to make people aware that NASDAQ is a viable stock market and that we are a viable competitor to yours and that we've got great companies that trade in NASDAQ. In fact, we think they're the gazelles rather than the elephants that you've got and that these are the companies that are the future of America tomorrow. You know, and obviously they're interested in making the public, investing public, much more aware of the market in which those securities trade and being comfortable with that market because they wanted to satisfy their investors.
Right.
And they understood that. I mean, it didn't take the guys that are running Microsoft, Intel, MCI, et cetera, very long to realize that.
Right.
So we increased the fees primarily for the larger companies. The smaller companies, we didn't increase them. We increased them slightly, but not much.
Yeah. A couple other things that are happening in this period here is you're making a few initiatives into the international stock market. You were working with London, I think, a little bit.
Yes.
Did that work out, or was
yes and no. You know, let me just give you an aside here. going back to the structure of NASDAQ and the NASD, because we'll eventually get to 1996, you had the NASD, which owned two companies, NASDAQ National Market Systems and NASDAQ Quotation Systems. These two companies were not-for-profit entities, and the earnings that they had were not taxed. So we were able to use those earnings to plow back into the development of the systems and improvement of systems. But at some stage in the game, in the late 80s again, around the 89, 90 era, we got to the point where we were start making profits that we couldn't plow back. I mean, we had profits that were exceeding what we were putting back into the systems. And secondly, these were for-profit entities, and we said to ourselves in our strategic planning, NASDAQ is a business. It's a for-profit business. So why should we keep these two tax-exempt entities? So we consolidated them into one tax-paying entity, the NASDAQ Stock Market, Inc.
About when did you do that?
We did that shortly before, I'd say it was 89 or 90. It's shortly before we began the campaign.
Okay.
Because we really wanted the NASDAQ stock market to be viewed as a good citizen,
right,
tax-paying, for-profit entity, a business. We were going to run it as a business.
Right.
And that was a change, and that's when we adopted the name, the NASDAQ Stock Market, Inc. Before that, it had been NASDAQ Market Systems, NASDAQ Quotation Systems.
Right.
And that was an important structural change, both internally and also among our members. And I think for the eventually for the benefit of investors, but also for our companies as well. Because in effect, we had three constituencies: the investing public, our members, and the companies that listed in NASDAQ, and that was true throughout my tenure. So, coming to the international side, about the same time, these companies were saying, "Hey, I mean, this was really again not forced on us, but." Initiated by the listed companies, the Microsofts of the world were saying, I mean, I'd meet with Mike Brown, who was their CFO. Mike would say to me, you know, we're an international company. We sell products all over the world. Microsoft and Intel and Cisco, they were all global companies. And they're saying, you know, we want a market where our securities can be traded anywhere in the world, any time of the day. Well, okay. So I understood their initiative. I mean, their concerns. And I went to the London Stock Exchange. And I went to the London Stock Exchange because, one, it was... at that stage in the game, after New York, it was the second largest stock exchange in the world. But in the late 80s, with our technical assistance, they had moved from becoming a floor-based auction market to an upstairs screen-based dealer market. And they were employing NASDAQ technology to do that. So it was a natural partner to look to.
Right.
And I started conversations with them. We exchanged technical people. We looked at ways we could do things together. We did start trading NASDAQ securities from London at when the London markets opened, which were basically 4 a.m. our time. I started negotiations and conversations with the Japan Securities Dealers Association, and they subsequently created a market called JASDAQ, which again employed our technology and our systems. And But we never got anything formal going in the way of trading with them. That was primarily for the gazelles of Japan. But with London, we started this joint initiative. And then, you know, I continued to pursue that through... so that got us involved in the international markets. The other thing that what I started doing just about the same time, saying, all right, if we're going to be truly a global player, we better get some people advising us who know something about international markets. Mm-hmm. So I created something called the International Markets Advisory Board. And enlisted primarily people from the sell side, from big institutions around the globe. And the initial chairman was a guy named David Brook, who had been with S.G. Warburg in London. And we had people from on that advisory board from, you know, all the major markets around the globe. London, which had people from the U.S., London, Germany, France, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Japan, Australia, China wasn't a factor then, and
this became a regular part of
it became an advisory board that we met with twice a year.
Okay.
Continued throughout my tenure. But what we learned with the advice of that, on the advice of that, but not with the unanimous consent of that advisory board, I approached the London Stock Exchange probably in 1992 and said, why don't we merge the two and become one entity? And the technical people and a number of their members and the market makers of London Stock Exchange were very enthusiastic about it. And it finally went to a vote of the London Stock Exchange board, and it was voted down. And the chairman, who was a friend of mine at the time, told me it was largely done on a nationalistic basis, that London just did not want to abandon the concept of not having a London Stock Exchange. And he said, strategically it makes sense, you know, technically, from a technological point of view, it makes sense. Our markets are very compatible. Yeah, we'd love to be able to trade NASDAQ stocks here, and have you trade London Stock Exchange stocks there, and we could have a trading day. You know, that. Well, they got voted down, so...
It's too early for that.
Too early for that.
I want to get into...
So that, you know, I say yes and no.
Yeah.
It did lead to us starting to trade NASDAQ stocks earlier from the European continent. And from, but it was the American firms with their trading desk overseas that were doing that.
Right.
So, you know, we were accommodating foreign buyers and sellers, but we were not truly a... an international or global market.
Right. I want to start moving into the later years here.
Okay.
And you, I know that, you know, you did build up your participation in the NASDAQ considerably. I mean, things really started growing.
When we started the branding, coming back to that 20% number,
yeah.
After we had done that for 1 year, we did a survey of what we call... MEPs, managers, executives, and professionals. And that was our first survey, the one that said 87% New York Stock Exchange, 39, 20. After a year, we were up to a 60% recognition. Wow. And after 2 years, we were up to an 81% recognition. So when people say, tell me about, and that's the power of advertising,
yeah.
Really. I mean, they recognize the brand.
That's huge.
And that was huge.
So,
and I ran into huge opposition. First from the New York Stock Exchange, which was totally opposed. They eventually came around and started their own advertising campaign, which was fine.
Right.
But You know, and then when Arthur Levitt became the chairman of the SEC, he also was totally opposed to it. So he tried to get us to stop. And I kept saying, he and I always had a strained relationship because going back to the days when I was trying to get Blue Sky Law exemption for NASDAQ stocks, he was head of the American Stock Exchange. And he knew that if we were successful, that that would have a very negative impact on the American Stock Exchange. So he fought us tooth and nail on that. And now the advertising campaign was really going to, and by that time he'd become chairman of the SEC. So he tried to get us to stop. And we said, hey, Arthur, this is a business. Right. You know, we're running a business. And we're competing against not only the New York Stock Exchange now, but increasingly for listings with the London Stock Exchange and the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And that's, you know, if we're just a quotation system or even an execution system doing small United States stocks, we're dead.
Right. So with this growth, you did some infrastructure upgrades.
Oh, yes.
And which, again, you're doing the infrastructure, which makes it possible to do more with the software. Right. I noticed you put in some programs, something called NProve, something called Access.
That's the same program.
Okay, it's the same program.
That
leads you to the SEC, I guess, and some issues with whether
Absolutely.
You do it or not.
Absolutely. So, just a couple of oversight. During this period of time, you know, a lot of my senior management time was devoted to NASDAQ Matters because I was the CEO of both. Mm-hmm. In retrospect, I probably should have been spending more time, not the majority of my time, but more of my time with the NESD and NESD Matters. That had been running well. You know, we did make some significant changes during this in the 90s in terms of taking over all of the testing requirements from the states and from the exchanges and administering a uniform test for anybody that wanted to come into the industry. And then we developed on our own the continuing education requirement, which is one of the things that I'm as proud of on the NESD side as anything I did on that side of the business. And we finally got that in place over industry objection in 1995. And I think that was a major step forward in making sure that those people who were dealing with the investing public were current in their knowledge, not only of products, but of rules and regulations. Because I'd always been of the view that if you can make people aware of and knowledgeable about the rules and regulations, it's less likely that they will violate them. Because a lot of the violations that we came across in the NESD were inadvertent. Now, there were a lot that were intentional, but you weren't going to change that. I mean, the intentionals were the bad guys, and they're going to be the bad guys. You got 550,000 registered representatives out there. You're going to have probably 1% of them are bad guys.
As things changed and as the size grew, did you see any qualitative change in the kinds of violations that you were detecting?
Yes, we did. Another initiative, that we had during this period of time was that on the NESD side, and then I'm going to answer that question through this response. On the NESD side, beginning again in the late 80s and early 90s, after we got over the NASDAQ crash of 87, the biggest pattern of abuses were in the penny stock market.
Right.
And there were penny stock dealers, mostly in New Jersey and in the Pacific Northwest, in the Rocky Mountain area, that were bad guys. They were ripping off the public in a big way. And so we started an initiative with the state securities regulators, whereby we would attempt to stamp out a lot of those abuses. And by doing that, we put a lot of those penny stock firms out of business. And these were people that were really ripping off. They would buy millions of shares at a penny a share, and then they would promote them and sell them to investors at 9 or 10 cents a share, and then all of a sudden disappear, because they would have sold all their inventory to those poor investors, and these investors would have no place to sell. So all of a sudden, not only were they not worth a penny, they were probably worth zero.
Right.
And there was a lot of penny stock fraud that had built up over the years. And that became a big initiative of ours on the NASD side. And we worked closely with the state securities regulators on that. And where there was fraud, with the SEC. And we were successful. You know, the most notable case was a guy named Brennan in New Jersey, First Jersey Securities. And eventually put him out of business, and the SEC and the United States District Attorney for New Jersey eventually put Brennan in prison. But we had a lot of examples. I cite that because that was probably the most public. And we had the help of the media in that, too. The media was very helpful. The media is a great friend of regulators and law enforcement officials. And because if you can get them on your side exposing a lot of these bad practices, it makes the consumer much more aware. And so we actively worked through our PR group to get the media involved in these activities. So that was a good joint initiative. So those were two things on the NASD side that we were doing. One, increasing the professionalism of our registered representatives, and two, much more aggressively ferreting out the worst practices, particularly in the penny stock markets. Then, as a result of what we did with the markets and the SOS system and increasing the automation, during the mid-90s, 93, 94, 95, 94, 95 more, we started to see abuses of that system being built up by the so-called SOS abusers. And
so they were
day traders. And basically they were using the SOS system to pick off market makers who were not timely updating their markets. And they were, when you could do 1,000 shares at a pop, and with technology that was available, within a matter of minutes, you could do hundreds of thousands of shares, because our systems were capable of doing that. During this period, we were building capacity in NASDAQ. Looking forward to days when there would be a billion share trading days. Mm-hmm. And so we kept building capacity. So we had this capacity in NASDAQ, and we can execute transactions in nanoseconds, really. And so the SOS abusers first started not with day traders, who were investors, but with a small handful of former penny stock brokers. They quickly, when we put them out of the penny stock business, they moved over to the SOS business. And these guys were making the market makers, who had their capital at risk, furious. And they were screaming at us to do something about it. The only thing we could really do was make sure that they were not abusing the systems, and two, that they were not naked shorting, which a lot of them were doing. And I assume you know what naked shorting is. They were just selling stocks that they didn't own. Without having made any arrangements to borrow those securities. So you were asking me about changes in the regulations. So we spent a fair amount of time on the SOS abuse issue now. And eventually that migrated into a more legitimate business called day trading. And that's when the public got involved. And some of these guys were pretty smart. They said, there's a real business here. So they would put up lots of computer terminals in their offices. And previously, only NASDAQ systems had three tiers. If you as an investor were looking at a NASDAQ screen, you could see only the best bid and ask and the last sale information. That's level one. And by the way, we sell that information for a fee. That was how we generated revenues. Then there was level two. That's where any member of the NESD could see not only that information, but every individual market maker, because market, you know, stocks like Microsoft, I keep using them as them. The large ones had 30, 40, 50 market makers. And even the small ones would usually have half, five or six market makers. So any NESD member could go to level two and see, one, what the current market was, and two, take a look at where individual market makers were. And if they were off the market, they could. And then number three was the execution capability. And only registered NASDAQ market makers and registered NASDAQ traders could have access to level three. They could execute through their systems. But what these guys did was they put up a lot of terminals, which were supposed to have only level one information on it, and they would take them right to level three. So if I'm an individual investor, it was like me going to the slots at Atlantic City. I could go in, sit down behind this terminal, sit there, and I could trade all day. And you know, whether they put up the capital, because at the end of the day, the goal of the day trader is to be even.
Right.
He wants to start the day even. He wants to end the day. And instead of these being firms, which could do that legitimately, these were individual investors. And that was how the day trading. Well, the issue there became, hey, were these guys, in effect, trading all day without any money, without ever putting up any capital, any margin?
Right.
And we found a lot of them were not. So eventually cracked down on that, and that led to the, not the demise, but to the reduction of abuses of the day, by the day traders. But there were some pretty smart people out there that learned quickly how to use these terminals to manipulate the system.
Could you show limit orders anywhere in any of those levels?
I'm sorry?
Limit orders? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the issues here.
You're leading me nicely. You're doing a good job. So that's where we were. And I'll give, even though Arthur Levitt and I went back and forth on a number of issues, he came to us and he said, you know, you're doing a lot of good things, but there's a lot more than you need to do to improve the quality of the markets. In the exchange markets, we gave limit order protection, the American New York Stock Exchanges, and you don't do that in NASDAQ. And he was right. So he said, I encourage you, and that was his words, I encourage you to develop limit order protection. Because we had an old rule called the Manning Rule, that if, and it came out of one of the disciplinary cases, where Manning filed a complaint against one of our market makers for failure to execute a limit order and for trading ahead of his order, his limited priced order. And he won the case. And that was back in the 80s, mid-80s. And it was before my time, the Manning case. Yeah, it was 85, I think. And so the NESD at the time said, okay, how are we going to deal with this? Well, they came up with it. If the market makers disclosed to the public that they did not honor limit orders, then they would not have to accept customer limit orders. And that Manning Rule was in effect all during the second half of the 80s and the first half of the 90s. And so Arthur came to us and he said, basically, you know, why don't you consider doing this? And I encourage you to do it. Well, the chairman of the SEC encouraged you to do something. You take a hard look at it. Our market makers were totally opposed to this. They just... that was a hard sell. And so I said, okay, let's try to do this in two pieces. Let's eliminate the notification requirement and the exemption that we created under the Manning Rule, and require our member firms to honor their customers' limit orders, and they would have to execute those limit orders ahead of their own market-making activities. Well, you would have thought I had stuck a dagger in their heart. And kicking and screaming, we finally got it passed by the NASD board. The SEC, and notably Chairman Levitt, were not satisfied with just that. And they wanted us to take the other step is that you had to expose and honor any investor's limit orders, not just your customer's limit orders.
Right.
Well, that was something that I couldn't sell to the market making community. And the SEC had to adopt their own rule requiring us to do that. It was the right thing to do, but we couldn't get it done with the governance structure that we had in place then, where 17 out of the 22 members were from the securities industry, and they were largely, not totally, but largely representing NASDAQ market-making firms.
Right.
So.
And you got it done later. You didn't get it done then.
Well, the NASD got it done later, but it was because
of the
pressure of the SEC. We got the first half done.
Was that the order handling rules?
Yes, those were the order handling rules. Yeah. And, you know, they forced our hand on that. They were right. I just didn't have the support of my members.
Right.
And it resulted, again, in an overall improvement in the quality of the marketplace and encouraged more people to participate. So, yes, their profits per transaction went down, but the volume of the transactions went up. We had done another thing in the interim, too, in the 93-94. Quotations, historically, in the United States had always been done in fractions. And, you know, every quarter point spreads or eighth point spreads, or sometimes in less liquid stocks, half point spreads. And that was true and the less liquid the stock, the wider the spread. And during the early 90s, this was investor driven. This was more driven by the institutional investors. And representatives of the individual investors, saying, you know, these spreads are too wide. And you ought to facilitate, by changing your systems, the ability of market makers to trade in narrower fractions. Over the objections of the NASDAQ market making community, we did. We modified our system so they could trade in 16ths.
Okay.
So for the first time, and the institutions were delighted, because on the exchanges they were trading at that stage in the game, probably at 6, 7, 8 cents a share, let's say 6 to 7 cents a share. But because our minimum spread was an eighth, it was 12.5 cents a share on our side. So we got it down to 16ths, and that's 6 2/3 cents a share. And that's where most of the liquid stocks eventually traded. The spreads turned, instead of being 20 to a quarter or 20 to a half or 20 to an eighth, they were 20 to a sixteenth.
So is this where the concern about spreads really started?
Yes.
At this point,
yes,
with the institutional.
And so, well, yeah, but then there were some academics taking a look at the same issue. And those academics you know, came out, two of them, a fellow from Stoltz from Ohio State and a fellow from Vanderbilt, the Owen School, came out with a study in 1994,
right.
Which said, hey, not only are these spreads too wide, but there's a stubborn pattern among the market makers in having their quotes all with the same spread. You know, on a stock, a stock would have a quarter of a point spread, not some market makers at a quarter, not some at a half, not some at an eighth. And we, by that, at that stage in the game, I don't think states were quite, we were working on the system, but they weren't there yet. And they said, this seems something more than coincidental. They did, they studied the trading pattern around merge stocks, and they came to the conclusion that it was more than coincidence, it was collaboration. Right. And so that study became public. And then we got the NASD and NASDAQ were challenged on that.
Is that the first you heard of it, is when it came became public?
Yeah. Well, was that the first time I'd heard of
yeah,
it?
Yeah, the folks at NASD.
We had had one person about a year before that who internally, and he was the, he worked in our NASDAQ market operations group in Trumbull. His name was Glenn Shipway. And Glenn, one of his responsibilities was market quality. And Glenn, in a report to us, had suggested that we should start to take a look at collaboration among market makers and establishing. I turned that over to the head of our enforcement group, the guy that oversaw market surveillance.
Is that John Pinto?
That was John Pinto. Mm-hmm. And asked John to explore it. John went out, and he and his staff and the examiners went out and found John Pinto. John was the boss. He had a guy that ran the districts, and then he had a guy that ran the market surveillance, and the guy that ran market surveillance was a guy named Jim Cangiano. And they went to a number of the market makers, talked to the market makers about the issue. They concluded it was not a significant issue. And so we didn't do anything about it. In retrospect, that was a mistake, a big mistake. Yeah. Looking back, if I had to do something differently, I would have had them drill down further and probably should have bought in an independent outside group. Mm-hmm. Because, again, NASDAQ was then growing to the point it was no longer that tail. I mean, it was the tail that was wagging the dog. I mean, it was growing into a real business, big thing, you know, generating lots of money for both the NASDAQ Stock Market, Inc. And we were using that money to fund a lot of our NASD activities so that we didn't have to have significant assessments on our members. Right. And even though a lot of our members, I mean, we had 5,400 members, I would say less than 1,000 of them were engaged in general securities markets activities. Hmm. A lot of them were insurance companies that were selling variable annuity products that had a securities feature to it. A lot of them were selling mutual funds only. A lot of them were selling financial planning. And so they were not involved at all with the NASDAQ stock market. Could care less. I mean, mm-hmm. I won't say could care less. As a member, they owned a piece of it.
Right.
And we were using that profits to underwrite our activities over here.
Right.
So, cash cow. I mean, generating. So I really don't think either at the staff level or at the board level there was a push to really penetrate that issue more deeply. And then, lo and behold, the Department of Justice got hold of that report. And they, on their own volition, without even informing the SEC, undertook a review of trading practices in the NASDAQ stock market to determine whether there was a violation of the antitrust laws.
Right.
In fact, when the SEC learned about it, they were not happy about the fact that the Department of Justice had initiated that without conferring with them. And they felt it was within their jurisdiction as the oversight of the NASD and NASDAQ to undertake not only securities law reviews, but any type of review. Well, there was a little push and shove there for a while, but finally they got together and agreed, you know.
And the SEC did undertake their own study.
They did, but it wasn't with a view to determine whether there had been a violation of the antitrust laws.
Right.
The SEC undertook their review to determine whether the NASD was carrying out its responsibility for regulating and supervising the NASDAQ stock market effectively. And that's how those two... So there were two good studies ongoing.
And then you had your own, or one that you'd undertaken.
And so when that all broke, timing is everything. That was in the summer of 1994, and late spring, early summer. Well, it was about that time that I discovered that I had prostate cancer. And that I was going to have a radical prostatectomy. And then initially it was scheduled for August of 1994, eventually delayed to October of 1994. But during that period of time, the NASD board, obviously with my full support, decided that, you know, SEC had its investigation underway. The Department of Justice has an investigation underway. We should constitute an independent group to review the issues of the structure of our organization, the whole organization, and whether that was still an appropriate structure given the size and growth of NASDAQ. And also, and because we didn't want to duplicate what the SEC was doing, or so we didn't certainly want to do anything having to do with the Department of Justice, what they were doing, and they didn't want us to. And two, whether not only was that structure the appropriate structure, but two, whether the NASD had effectively carried out its oversight responsibilities for the NASDAQ stock market. So we had Rudman, and who was a very independent guy. And his committee got the report right here. I still think it's my marked copy, but it, when you called me, I said, I better go back and read that thing. But Warren and his committee did a thorough job, and they, I mean, it was a very good group of people. And I think there was only one industry representative on it, and it was Steve Hammerman, who was the general counsel Steve was the general counsel of Merrill Lynch and was highly regarded in the industry. But we had an institutional investor, Peter Lynch. We had a dean of the University of Pennsylvania Law School, Bob Mundheim, who had been a member of the NASD board as a public representative. We had Irv Pollack, who is the greatest name in securities regulation history, in my judgment. And Al Sommer, who was one of the all-time great SEC commissioners. And so they undertook that review, and then in, what's the date of the report? The date of the report is 1995, September 15th, 1995. They issued their report, and in the meantime, we had these other reviews going. And subsequently, the Department of Justice instituted an action, not against the NASD or NASDAQ, but against the market makers.
Right.
We were never a target of the Department of Justice. Or to my knowledge, we were never a target. They never told us that we were a target.
Right.
They were focusing on the market makers and whether they were colluding to fix prices in the NASDAQ stock market. The SEC, on the other hand, was very much taking a look at the NASD and NASDAQ and their oversight responsibility. And so these three things were going on all together. And I forget the timing that the Department of Justice bought its action. I think it was in early 96. The SEC was willing, even though they had their study going on, their investigation going on at the same time, they were willing to, before they made any determinations, they were willing to await the outcome of our study. Mm-hmm. And they did.
And DOJ came out first, right?
And DOJ came out first, mm-hmm. Yeah. They bought the action, and then the market makers eventually settled that action, paid $1 billion into a pot, right, which at the time was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Today's world, you know, it's not atypical for those types of penalties, and the firms all had to participate in it. And then you had, as you always do, by the way, when I was practicing law with Miles and Stockbridge back in the, one of my big cases was an antitrust case, a cement pipe price-fixing case. And anytime you have a settlement with the Department of Justice, which we did, and I was representing American Marietta and eventually became Martin Marietta, mm-hmm. The civil suits follow.
Right.
And they did.
Right.
They never named the NASD and NASDAQ, but they sued the market makers.
Right.
So in addition to the $1 billion, the market makers had to deal with all this.
So the Redmond report gives you essentially the split the two in half.
Absolutely.
You've got the operations,
yeah,
and you've got the regulation.
Absolutely.
Had that been, I mean, was it an aha thing, or had that been something?
No,
that was
it wasn't an aha thing. I'll be real candid with you. It's something we had discussed internally at the staff level and some of our planning efforts. I mean, this goes back to the 93, 94 area, when we were really had made a conscious effort to start to build and brand the NASDAQ stock market, mm-hmm. Start to improve it to the point where it could compete with any stock market in the world. And we kept saying to ourselves, you know, should we have a separate governance structure for NASDAQ? Well, the NASD board, again, was never really willing to give it up.
Right.
And they didn't, it never came again to a formal resolution, but we discussed it with them as
right.
part of our strategic planning initiatives.
Another example of something that may not have been possible before
right.
the market makers scandal.
Absolutely.
Okay. So now you're looking at separating the two and bringing in
right.
new
and they represent, and by the way, I endorse that. We as an organization endorsed that. We thought that it was the right thing to do given the growth of the NASDAQ stock market, given our failure to properly pursue the market-making scandal over here, and given the investigation that the SEC was undertaking, and it was decidedly unfriendly. I mean, it was people like Rick Ketchum, who had been a star at the SEC, was personally at odds with a number of his former contemporaries. And it really became quite an unfriendly, unfortunately, situation. And so we endorsed it and said, you know, it's the right thing to do. And if we're going to do this, then we've got to bring in somebody from the outside of the organization that is going to be impeccable in her credentials to oversee regulation. We knew that we had an image problem. At both the NASD and NASDAQ. Interestingly, by that time, NASDAQ had grown into such a significant market force. We thought the image problem of NASDAQ, particularly since NASD and NASDAQ were not named in those suits, would be much far easier to overcome.
Hmm.
We could overcome that with some more marketing and advertising and making sure that our lead companies stayed with us, which they all did. And so we brought in two people, and we brought in Mary Shapiro, who had been not only a commissioner at the SEC, but also the chair of the CFTC. And Mary has had then, and as far as I know, still has a great reputation.
How'd you convince her to come over?
Wasn't easy. Mary was, I think, getting a little antsy being in the public sector. She had been at the commission and then at the CFTC and, frankly, you know, earning at that level. Right. And we at the self-regulatory level paid considerably more. Her husband was a teacher at the University of Maryland. Okay. And she was beginning to have a family. And in fact, she'd already had one child, Molly, and then subsequently had another daughter. And Mary, didn't, I think, what she was wanted to start to wanted to really, one, make some money, but two, to have a bigger challenge.
Right.
And so.
It's a big challenge.
So it was a big challenge. And she was also being wooed at the same time by the New York Stock Exchange, who offered her a job.
Okay.
And they offered her a job, not as an executive vice president with fairly broad responsibilities. The advantage we had was Mary lived in Washington. She loved Washington. She had a happy home life there, children and a husband. And so while we didn't pay her as much money as she could have earned the New York Stock Exchange, she, I think, was eager to take on the challenge. And two, I think she really wanted, she could wouldn't have to change her lifestyle that much. Mm-hmm. So we were fortunate. We hired Mary to run NESD regulation. It gave her full authority over the NESD regulation and the staff and the board.
Good-sized budget as well.
Right. And we increased her budget, yeah. Part of our settlement with the SEC was that when that happened in 1996, was that we would increase the amounts that we we'd increase the budget of the NESD regulation by $100 million. Mm-hmm. That wasn't a problem in terms of dollars. We didn't have to go out and assess our members because we built this pool over NASDAQ, and we had a lot of reserves at the time, so we were able to fund that. And then to run NASDAQ, in 1995, I hired a former colleague of mine at Alex Brown by the name of Al Berkeley. And Al was a institutional investor, all-star analyst, first guy to cover the computer software industry as an industry, different from the hardware companies. He then became a very successful software banker. He helped Alex Brown snag with Goldman Sachs the Microsoft deal. I mean, he knew all the players in the technology industry. Plus, he also had extremely bright, a complete understanding of how the systems work that drove the NASDAQ market. So he was technologically sophisticated. He also knew the CEOs of many of our leading companies on a first-name basis. So I hired him to become president and COO of the NASDAQ stock market.
Where was Rick Ketchum in here?
Was he Rick was side-by-side with me throughout.
Okay.
I had hired Rick going back in 1991 when Rick, again, had been at the SEC for most of his career, living in Alexandria, Virginia, and had a young family of three children and a wife. And, you know, Rick had risen to the level, the most senior level that he could have achieved without becoming a commissioner as chairman, as head of the Division of Market Regulation. He had worked successfully with us and the exchanges to offset the problems that were revealed in the market crash of 1987. Those issues were largely behind him. I think he was looking for a new challenge. And I approached him and said, listen, I need somebody with your knowledge, your skills of both the regulatory side and the market side.
Right.
That appealed to Rick a lot because he did not want to be tagged at that stage in his career just as a regulator. And so I brought him in as the number two person in NESD. And he became, I was the president and CEO, he became the EVP and COO.
Right.
For a short period of time, because of the general counsel that we had had there for years, a fellow named Frank Wilson was nearing retirement, I said, Rick, would you come in for a year or less until And I'll make you the general counsel until Frank retires. And then you can, and then we had a fellow named Grant Callery that we promoted general counsel, and Rick became the number two guy in the organization, EVP and COO. And he was largely responsible for overseeing the day-to-day activities of both the NASD and NASDAQ. Okay. And I became less involved with the day-to-day activities and more involved with dealing with investors, members, and companies. So Rick was more of Mr. Inside,
right,
and I became more of Mr. Outside. When I first got there, I was both, but it soon became clear to me that I couldn't do it all.
Okay.
So having somebody like Rick was a godsend.
Moving on from...
So Rick was there all throughout this period, right, as the number two guy in the organization.
Right. So you've set up this this new structure where you've got the NASD, and then you've got the stock exchange, the stock exchange and the regulation.
We've got NASDAQ Stock Market Inc., NASD Regulation Inc., separate legal entity,
right,
and the NASD is a holding company, no longer is an operating company.
Right.
And this was pursuant to the recommendation.
Now, it sounds like it would have been a challenge just sort of getting this machine up and running and making that move.
It wasn't as hard as you thought. I mean, because the day-to-day functions didn't change. What changed was the corporate structure and the governance. It was the governance changed dramatically. Because at the NASD level, instead of having an overwhelming majority of industry members, we were going to have, on the basis of the recommendation of this Rodman Committee, we were going to have a majority of non-NASD members on the board. And then on the other two boards, it was going to be 50-50.
Yeah.
Real change.
Did you see that? Were you there long enough afterwards to see that change happen?
Yes. And I actually recruited almost all the people that served on those various boards.
Okay. The outside people.
Yes. Now, that didn't make me particularly popular with the industry because, we had to take an entity that they had control in terms of governance for since 1939 to 1996. So, I worked through that in 1996. And, at the parent board level, not so much at the NASD regulation or at the NASDAQ board level. And by the way, we've been moving in that direction at the NASD level. We went through a couple of iterations. When I first got there, I think there were only three. It was 22, 19 of which came from the industry. Three came from investors, member issuers, and the general public. General public usually being represented by academics like Bob Munheim. And then early on, after I consolidated some of the districts, we got that to five. And then by the time, even before any of these recommendations, we were down to 14 and 8, I think. So we were steadily increasing the non-member representation on the board. We were moving in that direction.
And I take it that there's some resentment building up from those people who had been out in the regions and
yes,
formerly been very important.
Very important because, we had, when I got there, I think 13 districts, and they had 19 seats. I consolidated that into 10 districts, and they had 17 seats. And then even after they had 17, we took three more away from them. So, 5,400 firms, everybody thinks of Merrill Lynch and Smith Barney and all the big guys and Morgan Stanley.
Right.
But the vast number of firms had less than 100 employees. Many of them were one- and two-person operations. And they had, through their elected district representatives to the board, enormous power. Enormous power.
So some of it was breaking that power.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And it wasn't easy.
And that's something Frank said.
And I couldn't, I mean, I can be honest. I would not have been able to do this alone. Without this report, and without, and I grudgingly give him credit, Arthur Levitt's insistence. Mm-hmm. And he even came to one of our board meetings, and was very coldly received, but basically telling us that we had to move more aggressively in that direction and to get to at least the 50-50.
Was it after the report came out that he did this?
Yes, it was in January.
So he's just kind of saying, hurry up here.
Yeah.
Yeah, hurry up and implement.
Yeah, yeah. And I remember, I mean, it was only his forceful, I won't say his forceful jawboning, and this report, and the Department of Justice actions, and the SEC's pending actions. Have you ever seen a copy of this?
I have not. I'm going to get a copy of that.
Oh, absolutely.
If I could, yeah.
If I had a clean copy, I'd give it to you. It's just got all my notes in it.
That's fine. I'll be looking at one very soon, I'm sure.
All right.
We've gone a little over 2 hours. Is there anything that we should hit before we wrap up?
Just a couple of things, I think. So we implemented this, and it went, I mean, and it, I was going to start to say, you know, the SEC gave us fairly wide latitude in the makeup of our NESD regulation board, as long as we comply with that 50-50 requirement, the same thing to the NASDAQ board. But on the NESD holding company board, they wanted to be, and Arthur was involved in every decision as to who sat on that board, because that was the holding company board, and then he's the one that insisted on Dan Tully becoming chairman of that board. Okay, so two things I want to finish up on. So that all happened during 1996. I announced in June of 1996 that I was going to be leaving at the end of that year, and that a search would be undertaken for my successor, and we formed a search committee, which Dan Tully chaired, and eventually they hired Frank Zarb. And Frank was hired for a number of reasons. One, he was a skilled executive, but two, he was a former business partner and a very good friend of Arthur Levitt's.
Right.
So one of the things the board knew, and they were right, was that we had to repair our relationships with the SEC. And indeed we did, because they had become quite strained during this last 2 years.
The process was kind of long. You stayed there a little longer than one would have expected.
Well, I was determined not to leave until, one, this report had come out, and two, that it had been implemented. But we had it implemented by then. And don't remember, going all the way back to my opening comments when I was hired, I agreed to stay at least 5, but not more than 10 years.
Yeah.
And by that time, I had been there about 9.5 years. And when I told them I was going to leave, it was 9 years.
Okay.
When I left, it was 9.5.
Okay.
So now, as my parting swan song, and I don't know whether you'll be interested in this or not, but I do think it's, I mean, I've got some talks that I gave here, and I can make copies of you. During this period of time, beginning in 94, going through 96, but in January of 97, I had been a member of something called the Securities Regulation Institute. That was a group of lawyers, industry practitioners, regulators, and they would have an annual meeting in San Diego. And this is the last talk I gave, and then went up to Carmel, where my tenure came to an end. And in that talk, and Levitt was present in the audience, I talked about the demise of self-regulation and how through what had happened over the past 2 years. And the recommendations of both this committee in terms of not the governance structure, but in terms of the disciplinary process. Because they made some recommendations in here about how to change the disciplinary process and put in full-time hearing officers rather than a committee of your peers, that how they were taking the self out of self-regulation. I also suggested that the process in developing regulations, both by the NESD and by the SAC, had become so burdensome that it was took years to get any meaningful changes. And I cited Improve, and which had become NACSS, as being something that we were ready to go with systemically in 1994. And because the SEC wanted to little tinker with it here and tinker with it there and do this and that, it was still January of 1997. And it was designed to meet the SEC's new order handling rules. But they wouldn't let us do it. And it became increasingly a source of frustration. So, and how the process was overwhelming. Then lastly, and I think most significantly, for your purposes, I said, basically, and this is my, and a fellow named Steve Wallman, who was a commissioner at the time, and a smart guy, came out of one of the large law, Covington and Burlington, Washington. He jumped on this and made it a cause for himself while he was a commissioner. I called for the separation completely of regulation of the markets from the operation of the markets, and the elimination of the holding company and the formation of a separate entity. Which could be called the NESD or anything you want. Then I suggested the most logical step was to take all regulatory responsibilities away from all markets and to consolidate them into one self-regulator. So you would have the operation of the markets, which is a business, separate from the regulation of the markets and the members. And that was in 1997. Guess what?
Yeah, it's here.
2007, 10 years later, it's here.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
So that's the story.